You're listening to a Media Snackers and Design Chat podcast.
Well, hi, DK. It's great to be with you today. My name is Alan November, and I am a wanderer. I have an opportunity to go all over the world to present to educators and see schools and kids using emerging technologies. So like you, DK, it's just, it's not a job. It's it's really a lifestyle of being on the exciting edge of figuring out how we can improve learning. Sadly, we're generally not improving learning with tools, new digital tools. We tend to use them as a $2,000 pencil. And so my work is to try and convince schools that what we really need to do is stop thinking about technology and think a lot more about the kinds of assignments we give students and the expectations we have for our students, and engage students in more authentic kinds of learning, such as Skyping people around the world and creating podcasts and having live debates across the curriculum, and that we really need to re-engineer the job description of students, teachers, leaders, family, and community. And we're not quite there yet. So I think at this stage, we're still fascinated by our tools, and too many schools are buying too much stuff without thinking about a clear path to higher expectations and student achievement.
Great. Alan, thank you. This is Christian, and I really appreciate you spending time with us today. I want to play off of a couple of things you said. First of all, I love the description of wanderer, that in essence, you are a professional wanderer. In a certain degree, you were talking about re-engineering the job description for teachers and students, and there being a tremendous challenge in terms of our fascination with technology, but our inability to integrate it well into our learning programs. What is that job description for teachers and students once we start doing it well, that's not just fascination with the computer or the laptop or the tool itself?
Well, I think there are three basic skills, Christian, that form the framework for redefining the jobs of everyone in the system. One is to teach people how to deal with massive amounts of information, which at the higher end leads to more levels of critical thinking. So that's one, dealing with massive amounts of information. The second opportunity we have with all these new tools is similar to what we're doing right now, global communication, that every single classroom from preschool all the way through can be a global communication center where we teach children how to work with people all over the world and all the manifestations of what that means. It's actually quite engaged. But for now, just this sense that we have to teach students to be communication literate, organizing teams, maintaining relationships, building networks. It's quite a sophisticated set. But kids are social by nature, so it actually fits in developmentally. Third skill, I think, is going to take more time than the first two. Third skill has to do with being self-directed, that you do not need an organization to structure the work for you. This is the biggest problem of all in schools, because schools are designed to create the organization to structure the work for you. So if you buy into this model that the new emerging global economy requires people who are self-disciplined, self-directed, dealing with massive amounts of information, and have fantastic global communication skills, it's just very hard to find those things happening in schools. And so the job description, ultimately, we need to hold students to be much more responsible for managing their own learning, which represents a major shift of control, for example, from the teachers designing homework to teaching students to design their own homework. From teachers going off to staff development to learn things like podcasting, to students having jobs in schools, so there's a podcasting team. So it's just a whole rewrite of the balance of the control of information. I also think students ought to be curriculum researchers. We can teach them the basic skills of being able to research the websites of teachers, And students should just be constantly bringing resources to their own classes from all over the world, contributing to that resource base rather than have the teacher do that. So there's just this massive redistribution of who's doing what, but the general flow is that we need to hold kids much more responsible for managing their own learning.
And Alan, can I come in?
The family involvement.
Sorry.
Sure. Yeah.
I just wanted I just wanted to pick up on some of the rhetoric you were using there, which is very exciting for me and Christian. The wrong critical thinking, the global communication tools that already exist, and what teachers and self-directed work that young people should be doing. And I just wanted to ask you about that shift. You used the word shift, and is that reflective then of this shift that you were talking about? Is that just reflective of what kids are doing? And all you're doing is just almost shifting what kids are doing online with the online practices and technologies and giving it an educational framing?
Yeah, there's no question that kids are social when they leave school and they go home. I have two teenagers. They're downloading music. They're into iPod and they're using Instant Messenger. They tend not to be global. My daughter is more global than my son. He'll come home and talk to the same kids he saw in school that day with Instant Messenger. They're blogging, but again, their community is generally more local than global. And as I travel around, DK, I got to tell you, most kids don't know how Google works. Kids think they know. That's the scariest part to me. Kids think they know a lot more than their teachers know, and that's probably true. But most kids don't know how Google works. Most kids don't know how to backlink and map incoming links to a website. They don't understand critical thinking. It's stunning how many kids do not know how to create a podcast, even though they're downloading iTunes all the time. And most videos I see that kids produce are absolute crap. That sense of discipline, of storyboard, so while kids might be using the tools, it's my opinion that it's a myth that they're using them well and creatively. The average kid is only using these tools to serve their own interests rather than building global workplace skills.
Interesting. Now, and I got to.
Go ahead, DK.
No, I'm going to pass it to you, man. You're up.
Alan, I'd love to follow up on that. DK, thank you for that question, because that leads to something that I'd love, Alan, for you to talk about. Really appreciate you speaking honestly about the fact that it may be a myth that kids are, while they're using tools, they may know some of the technologies more so than their teachers. It's a myth that they're using them well, creatively, using them certainly on a local scale, but not as robustly as they could. Let me ask you this. If teachers aren't using them well, and their parents aren't using them well, and their mentors aren't using them well, and there's never been a time in history where anybody collectively is using them well, are we expecting too much from a 15 or 18-year-old to be using these revolutionary tools in a way that's revolutionary, or is this actually part of the process, given that it's only been a year, 5, 10 years, really? What should we be expecting students to do if their mentors aren't even in a position to guide them?
Yeah, no, there's no question, Christian. We're caught between a rock and a hard place. And in the United States, there's very little capacity for innovation and inventiveness in our schools because of our national testing system called No Child Left Behind, where we've really gone back to the 1950s. In terms of our curriculum, and you know, we get multiple choice tests. Then kids have these powerful tools, and literally, in fact, in my own work, the difference between the independent schools who are not held accountable to No Child Left Behind and the public schools is widening all the time. So you have students in independent schools who are studying Mandarin and engaging in fascinating MIT Media Lab stuff with powerful tools, Cricut and innovation software. And the public schools, just can't go there. So until the United States recalibrates what we do in terms of holding schools accountable, I have very little expectation that we're going to see an explosion of creative use of these tools. In fact, for the Americans who work overseas, people like Yang Zhao from Michigan State and Will Richardson and myself, we've all noticed that schools outside the United States, at least in the countries where we work, have much more capacity for managing change than we do here.
Well, is that the big point then, Alan? Is it about the culture, the cultural kind of pedagogy of teaching, whatever you want to call it, the semantics you can use, but it's about, at its heart, the culture of an organization, the culture of an institution then to change and its capacity, not resource, but more a capacity of a headspace capacity.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just give an example, DK. 2 weeks ago, I was in Britain, and I met with your education minister, who gave a keynote describing these tools. The education secretary of the United States, the equivalent of your minister, tried to zero out any federal investment in technology in the Bush administration, saying there was enough. So my government places almost no value in education technology at our national level. You can't find that kind of Singapore. You know, you find the education minister talking about critical global information processing skills, and you just don't find that in the United States. So one is capacity of our top leaders. The second level is capacity of our leaders within our schools. And we simply don't train our leaders in our certification process for licensing to be able to manage innovation and change. It just doesn't show up in the curriculum very much. And, you know, in England, you have a college geared just for school leadership that actually has residential immersion courses in managing change and technology. Nothing like it in the United States. So as an American, there's just no question that the United States is falling behind every year. And we invented these tools. That's the embarrassment. We just don't have the capacity to change in this country right now.
Alan, let me jump to something that strikes me as being very proactive and full of opportunity and something that's at the center of what you do. This summer in Boston, you're holding, if I believe it's your 7th or 8th Building Learning Communities Conference. And for a couple of days in Boston, you're bringing a really remarkable, diverse group of thinkers in terms of education, technology, et cetera, together. We don't have a lot of time left, but I'm curious, given what you've just said about the educational leadership landscape here in the U.S., given the fact that we tend to still be using $2,000 pencils, laptops that are essentially just word processors. What are you excited about in terms of the 3 or 4 days in Boston this summer that you think in the next year or two could really begin to shift the needle a little bit? Who's going to say something?
Yes.
What's going to be talked about in the hallways?
Well, for one, we're very lucky at our Building Learning Communities Conference because we do have people from around the world presenting, from India, from New Zealand, from Australia, from Ireland, from Scotland. And it will be stunning for some Americans who don't often have a chance to go to a global meeting to realize that there's incredibly creative work, probably more creative work, going on outside the United States. And because of the nature of the conference being very social, you know, we eat together and go out in a boat together, people will have a real chance to have conversations. In fact, the conference program is only an excuse to bring people together to have conversations. And so the long-lasting impact are the global connections where teachers will continue to work together and link their students when they return to schools in projects so that, at least on this side of the pond, American students will realize that there are different points of view around in the world, whether it's history, art, literature, And to value those different points of view, I think, is one of the most essential global communication skills. The other strength of the conference is we do bring in very high-end presenters. We have four-hour workshops at the MIT Media Lab with Mitch Resnick and his team, who have invented some incredibly powerful tools of kids creating whole virtual worlds where on their website, for example, if a student built an aquarium and you like a fish or a lobster that's in an aquarium, you can take that fish and that lobster and put it in your aquarium with all of the behavioral attributes coming with the fish and the lobster. So the MIT Media Lab is just pushing on the social networking side where you actually share inventions of what you create. I think lots of teachers are going to be blown away by that level of sophistication of what we can do today. We also have, Christian, as you know, you're doing a very exciting workshop with a colleague from Philadelphia on new school design. We're bringing a bunch of people to the Met School in Providence, which has completely re-engineered, you know, the day in the life of a teacher and a student. Incredibly exciting. We've got Yang Zhao from Michigan State, who may be our best scholar in the United States on what's happening in China and the global economy and education and technology. So it's an amazing mix of people from around the world and very, very powerful ideas. So I think we can guarantee that if you come, your brain will be tickled.
Well, Alan, thank you. I'm going to add one more question, and you hinted at that when you mentioned sort of the school design and the Met, et cetera. And I want to very briefly ask you about a recent series of conversations you had with Dan Pink, who you and I both know is really helping a lot of folks reimagine what we mean by education in terms of thinking about design and empathy and just the whole different way the brain can influence the way we problem solve, etc. So here's my question. The two of you, I found really strikingly, were talking about school design, quite literally the design of schools. And I'm wondering, in that conversation, I know you have a series of podcasts that are available on your site, what's one thing that you and Dan walked away from that conversation knowing is a truth about the future of school design? And neither of you are architects, so I find it really refreshing that your voices are exploring that. But what's one truth or one provocation that you and Dan see as being on the horizon line for school design?
Well, Dan made an interesting comment. He said, looking back as an adult, the people who have become the most successful aren't the smartest, necessarily. But the people have amazing persistence who simply don't give up. And he's impressed by being able to design spaces where we give students bigger problems than the typical homework assignment or project we currently do in schools, which to me means we need much more studio design space, which has a huge impact on the schedule. You know, time can be a killer of good space design. And so assuming that you can redesign time and space and relationships, those are the three big ones, time, space, and relationships, then my sense is we need much more studio space in schools where kids can work on problems for hours at a time over years, in fact, solving much more complicated problems in collaborative environments than we currently provide kids.
That's fascinating, man. I just want to wrap up the interview here. We're fast running out of time. So very much I want to ask you a question, and it's a very sky blue question, what we call sky blue over here, is if you could create the perfect school in terms of hardware, software, cultural design, whatever, if you had the power to do that, what would it be like and what would it look like?
Wow. I actually designed a school on an island in Boston Harbor. It's an outward bound. It is an outward bound center, but it also has science labs. So you have this amazing balance of nature where kids are in rowing boats or sailing boats, and they're tracking currents, and they're just engaged in the planet. And you know, that has to do with global warming and understanding natural processes and kind of return, you know, the whole Thoreau thing. And then along with that, there's just a rigorous sense of discipline of understanding numbers and science and creating art and music in this combination of, you know, indoor space. So my sense is that taking students inside, you know, the building isn't enough. No matter how well you design that building, it is never going to be enough until we return to some balance of immersing kids in natural learning environments outside.
Wow. Thank you.
Alan, I want to thank you. I mean, it was a great final answer because I've had a chance to take a boat and spend several days at that school and appreciated that connection with you. And I think it's a wonderful story and a reminder to all of us in terms of technology, education, the design of learning environments, et cetera. But most importantly, just thank you for your time and your voice.
Oh, Kristen, you guys are doing great work. We've got to push on this. Keep doing it. We've got to push on the school design. We're designing too many new old schools just because we say technology's in them.
Well, thanks very much for your time, Alan.
We are working very hard at it. Alan, thank you again for your time. It's been great. Just been great being in conversation.
Yeah, I look forward to the next one.
You're listening to a Media Snackers and Design Chair podcast. Check out the websites at mediasnackers.com and designchair.com.